cliffcentral.com.
Welcome to our business masterclass. I'm Richard Angus, CEO of the finance team, your part-time financial executive solution. Joining me in studio as part of our panel is Safia Boulay of New Habits, Making Shift Happen.
Welcome, Safia. Hi, Richard.
Nice to have you with us. Last week, we spoke to Michael Hinton on tax planning in your business, the issues that you need to consider and focus on. Today's theme is a really interesting one, and I'm really looking forward to this one. I have been thinking about this one for a while. We're talking the current state of the economy in South Africa and how this affects small and medium business. Joining us in studio today is our guest, Andrew Dwe, Director of Executive Education at the University of Witwatersrand School of Economic and Business Sciences. Welcome. Thanks for taking the time to be with us today, Andrew.
Thank you. Good to be here.
It's great to have you with us. So the world has gone through a massive change, the South African business world. We've had a finance minister, Pravin Gordhan, leave us, new finance minister, Malusi Gigaba, join us. Statements like radical economic transformation have been flying around in the press. We've had advisor to the new finance minister, Professor Chris Malikani, making statements about, you know, maybe we should be taking up arms. He suggested that maybe Venezuela and Zimbabwe should be our role models of success. And we've got downgrades from our rating agencies hot on the heels of all of these interesting changes. And as a consequence of that, I'm sure we're going to see borrowing costs grow or increase, and the impact on smaller business is just going to be significant. However, I think that's probably some of the more, let me call them the more obvious things, you know, cost of borrowing is going to go up, etc. But there are some other impacts that are out there that are, let's call them the things that stretch beyond the mere obvious and actually move into, the, let's call it, the areas that we perhaps don't talk about and don't make mainstream media per se, but impact on the small and medium business probably even more significantly than some of the headline stuff that everybody gets emotionally connected with. So today I wanted to explore, Andrew, with you some of those impacts that we're going to see. I mean, the first one that came to my mind is just this whole question of, you know, skills availability. You know, we're going to see as things start changing on the back of some of these changes that have been spoken about, you know, the whole question of the skills gap, education. I mean, we've seen fees must fall. How's this shift that's happened in our, let's call it, in our economic and financial environment of South Africa going to play out? And how's it going to impact on our small and medium businesses out there?
I work in the education area at a university, and we have last week on Monday, we've had more protests on campus, and these protests are coming about by students who are feeling that they simply can't afford to be at university. We have poor students with for whom we're helping with food, and there's a massive demand for residence and accommodation at all the universities, and the affordability has become the big issue. Now, last week in the Sunday Times, my Vice Chancellor, Professor Adam Habib, addressed the anger and the vigor of the protesting students, and he came up with some numbers. And if I may, I'd like to talk a few numbers. Let's just get clear in our minds what we're throwing around here. We throw around 30 million for an 18-month bonus. We throw around 247 million. But then we start to talk billions. And what Professor Habib is talking about, and his estimates per student are a bit lower than mine because he's looking at all the universities, not just the rather more expensive ones. And he says 25 billion a year for about a million students that we've got in all 28 universities. If you add accommodation to these students, to the cost, you're doubling that to his estimate is about 50 billion rand. Now, what is a billion? A billion is 1,000 million, so it's quite a lot of money. On the other hand, I personally believe that we could, in fact, have free tertiary education, and I've got ways of figuring it out, but there are a lot of counter arguments, and that is that it would be perhaps regressive, and that the wealthier middle class and wealthy students would also be benefiting, perhaps unfairly. And therefore, some of the argument says that we should help the poorer universities and the poorer students to a greater extent than we do middle class people. So these issues have been under discussion now for a good 18 months since we had the fees must fall.
And I guess for me, you know, the fees must fall conversation and then the changes that we're seeing now. I mean, the reality is, if you just look at what the impact is going to be of a ratings downgrade to junk status and what government is going to have to pay extra on borrowings that are currently in place, so no new borrowings, just the existing servicing existing borrowings, your 25 billion rand cost for free education at a tertiary level just disappears in the rounding.
Yep.
So I kind of look at this and I go, wow, okay, so we acknowledge as a country we have skills gaps. We acknowledge that the challenges of the past and the history of South Africa, we can remedy to a large extent by plugging an educational solution in, putting an educational solution in place. And here we've just kind of shot ourselves in the foot by making it more expensive to just do what we're doing already without adding to it. I mean, what is the impact of this going to be on business? I mean, should business be anteing up to this conversation and saying, well, we'll do something about the 25 billion rand problem?
I think we need to just step back a little bit and first establish, do we agree that education, and particularly tertiary education of different types, not just university, is necessary for the future of this country? And this, of course, brings in quite a lot of timing issues. We can have an immediate problem with an exchange rate and a recession and all sorts of things, but the students and the education is something that plays out, and the benefits are only realized in years to come. So assuming that we need education, what is happening with the private sector, you're saying, about businesses? Well, already it is apparent, and I don't have exact numbers from which companies are providing bursaries, but I do know that a university like Stellenbosch, Wits, Cape Town, Pretoria, UNISA, there are not a vast number of students there who are on bursaries, which are given by the private sector. So the private sector is already making a very big contribution to this cost. Now, what happens with the with a downgrading? We're looking at, and these are the Old Mutual economist Johan Els writing 2 weeks ago. He said that the new issuance, in other words, this year's additional bonds, additional borrowings by government, is 242 billion. Mm-hmm. That's on the table. Now, on that basis, if the, and we have the R168 bond issue at the moment at 8.3% coupon, if that rises, rises to 9%, it'll add 1.6 billion in costs on top of what the government is already paying. And the government debt is currently 2.2 trillion, which is just over 50% of our GDP, 2.2 trillion. And that's an awful lot of money. Now, 35% of that, if we get downgraded further by Standard & Poor's, Moody's, Fitch, there are some 38% of overseas investors in South African bonds who are mandated to withdraw those, to sell those. Now, we economists know that when you sell a bond and the prices drop, the interest rate goes up because the, we won't go into detail there, but because the coupon is fixed. So the government is going to have to pay more for any of these borrowings. Now, a country like ours, which is a developmental state, it needs to borrow. We can't diversify, we can't stimulate, we can't pay for infrastructure, education, healthcare, and all the other things that any country like ours needs if we don't borrow. We don't generate the kind of incomes through exports that we could that we could afford to pay for additional power, electricity, and all the other additional things that we have. So the stark reality is downgrade creates a sell-off of bonds, much of it compulsory, because
it's not elective, and I think that's kind of where we need to make sure that people understand this. I think there's a I've seen commentary where people say, X or Y or Z environment is conspiring against the South African government. Well, sorry, newsflash for everybody, there's no conspiracy. It's called international investment practice, and if you're an international investor, you invest in certain grades of asset, and if you go to junk status, you lose the designation. It's like saying, I have a driver's license, and if I lose my driver's license, I cannot drive anymore. Moving on. It's not personal. You did something. You behaved in a certain way. Your license was revoked. You no longer are licensed to drive on the road. And that's exactly what happens. The 38% you're referring to, sorry, you're not allowed to drive here anymore.
Look, that is an estimate, but the very big pension funds that invest in developing countries like ours and many others, it's their money. You know, we can say, oh, they're conspiring, they want to take their money away from us. It's their money. And they are mandated to invest at certain grades. And if a country like Somalia or North Korea falls out and becomes rogue, or the economy simply dries up like Zimbabwe, what are you going to do? You're going to withdraw your money. But they have to, because Prudential and even our own PIC, Public Investment Corporation, have got rules. They're not allowed to invest in junk. So they have to withdraw, and the effect of this will be to raise interest costs.
So I guess the message I'm hearing from you is, guys, on the one hand, you've got an education crisis and a need for funding, and at the same time we're shooting ourselves in the foot in terms of borrowing costs and trying to deal with and, so to speak, keep our heads above water as we're paddling in the environment. So perhaps, I mean, another area for me that is closely linked to this is this whole question of unemployment and kind of where the current economic challenges are around, just the depression that will happen in employment, and the ability of people to create business opportunities due to rougher and tougher economic conditions. I was recently, I saw a graph. The OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, had a graph of different OECD countries' unemployment and compared that with South Africa. And I mean, we're clocking in there at around the 25% level. If you compare that with the average for an developing OECD country, you're looking at their numbers are in at the 6-7% sort of level. And I look at this and I go, okay, and there are some outliers in that space. I mean, you look at somebody like Greece and Spain, they're also up there in the 22-25% levels. But unemployment is a huge challenge in this country. We all know this. Now, given what the current state of play, I mean, in my mind, we've made things worse, not better, by going through the current change. How do we turn that around, and what is the impact going to be on smaller businesses from an employment perspective?
Just looking at the background of this this awful number, I've got January 2017 numbers here. South Africa back up at 26.5. If it's any consolation, Namibia's is even worse. France, as we heard with last week's elections, that one of their issues is a 10.5% unemployment rate. They all want to retire at 55 and draw their government pension, so that's very nice. And yet we look at a country like India, which has a 3.6% unemployment rate, a country as vast as India.
Yeah, I was going to say, and let's not forget the numbers of people that we're talking in.
Absolutely. So in South Africa, what happens? What are we doing? Now, Professor Brian Cantor, University of Cape Town, he's now the economist also for one of the economists at Investec. He He was my first economics teacher back in the 1960s at university.
You're giving away your age.
Yeah, he's a monetary economist. And he came out 2 weekends ago. He addressed a gathering in Cape Town, and he said that there are three things that we can do about unemployment. And to me, as a free market economist, unlike my close colleague, who is the advisor to the minister, who is a Marxist, I'm a free market economist, and I tend to agree because that's what I was taught in the beginning. But Professor Brian Cantor says number one is growth, and he talks about growth, that we have to have growth. He's not talking about trickle down, make the wealthy wealthier, hope that it will trickle down. We've had all of these arguments in America just recently. He's talking about inclusive growth, that we should stimulate in the right way. We should stimulate certain industries which will employ people.
Now, I want to just understand, because you used an important word there, the words inclusive growth. What does that mean in the South African context? Can you give us a definition of that or just an outline of what
that
is?
Well, I think the idea is that everybody, and particularly the unemployed, have an opportunity to participate in this economy, and that it's not just to enrich people who are already very wealthy or government elites. I mean, we've seen this in Angola. We're seeing it badly in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, where you have people trying to stay in power, doing anything they can to stay in power, and they are skewing the economic growth. It's their elites, their families, and so on, who are becoming enriched. And as soon as there's a shock, like an oil price, a fall in the oil price in Nigeria, Angola, and so on, the poor get poorer. The rich don't care very much because they've got their assets probably stashed overseas and so on. So inclusive growth, as I read it, is that it includes the general mass of the population.
Hmm. Andrew, you know, I really struggle with this concept of inclusive growth because we're living in a world where technology is doing what people used to do. And it's speeding things up, and the challenge is not the same challenges that we had as recently as 10 years ago.
Yes.
I don't know of any businesses that I come into contact with that says we're going to employ more people.
That's the problem.
It's not part of how people think about employment.
Yeah.
So this is not only a concept of power and politics. This is a function of the world is changing.
Yes.
So this concept of inclusive growth, for me, it's one I can't get my head around.
Yeah. It's a very difficult one because if we look at some international examples, we are in the fourth industrial revolution. It's the knowledge economy. And we hear Sibanye Gold, Fruneman, Neil Fruneman, and people saying we're not going to invest anymore in South African mines. We are going to hedge ourselves internationally, even our industrial companies, instead of growing in South Africa, like Bell, like Steinhoff, they're investing overseas. And you're absolutely right. We're facing a dimmer and grimmer prospect of actually increasing unskilled employment. The mines, in manufacturing, mm-hmm. and so on. So what are we looking at in this fourth industrial revolution? We're looking really at the knowledge economy, and we're looking at educated people. We are not looking at ditch diggers, because in Johannesburg today, there are mechanical diggers, not people. And I saw some this morning. So you're absolutely right. Inclusive growth has got a very complex complexion to it, because it can take a very long time. As we said earlier, we're going to educate people, we're going to make them tech savvy, we're going to give them the skills. This takes time. And I think this is where we go right back to school.
So it's a complete reimagination
of
everything.
It is. Mm. It is.
And one of the interesting things that I've observed is, you know, we talk about, you know, let's call it the change in the economy of life and who's doing what and what are they up to and what are they doing. I mean, the World Economic Forum in Durban, they talked about how the world of education has changed and what people need to be educated for. And I found that quite interesting that, you know, they're talking about skill sets that, you know, it's not about learn a profession. It's learn a skill and the ability to be adaptive.
Yeah.
I mean, they talked about the ability to adapt and the ability to do, multitask. Now, that's a skill set that, you know, you're not going to find too many textbooks written about this that are sitting on the bookshops or, you know, on the internet.
Yet I think that is exactly what small business is all about.
Well, that brings me to the point of, you know, when it comes to creating, you know, the space for entrepreneurs, the barriers to entry are dropping rapidly.
Yeah.
I mean, I look at the world of work and how it's changed over the years. You know, before everybody had an office and you had to have a desk and you had to have, you know, all of this infrastructure around you. And nowadays, if you don't have to go into the office, that's a plus.
It's a keypad and connection.
Yeah. you know, what's more important, your parking space and your desk or free Wi-Fi? And, you know, and people are making those choices. And the barriers to entry in the, let's call it the knowledge economy, in that fourth knowledge economy, are fundamentally different to what we've seen in the past. But at the same time, you're now dealing with kind of other real challenges out there. And I mean, the one, and perhaps if we can just look at this one, is something that worries me is, you know, I see conversations of, you know, we talk about radical economic transformation. Those words flow, and I kind of still go, so what exactly does that mean? Does anybody actually know what that is? And then we also have this, you know, commentary is now flowing around land and redistribution of land again and all of these various conversations. And I go, well, okay, let's just have a quick conversation about agriculture, for example. I mean, where do we stand on that? That's inside this economic world we're talking about. Where is South Africa agriculturally, Andrew? How do you stand there?
Agriculture is diminishing as a share of GDP and has been over the last 20 years. Agriculture also appears to be becoming far more consolidated. We have had recent takeovers of by AgriSA of various other maize companies in the northwest province, places like Klerksdorp and so on. Recent big deals. Agriculture is becoming more and more sophisticated. It's not simply plant a few mealies and hope that you'll get something. Just to put that in perspective, we are having this year an estimated record crop of 15.6 million tons of white maize. And the last time we had that, anything near 15 million tons was in 1981.
Wow.
And that was just before that shocking drought that really devastated that entire industry. So there's agriculture. Looking at it, we are headed, and this is the good news. It means that food inflation is, whatever happens with imports, food inflation is becoming, it will be checked this year because of white maize, which is mainly for human consumption. We do import quite a lot of yellow maize, which is for animal consumption.
Mm. But I guess that then opens up the opportunity for that entrepreneurial space to, you know, I always say, well, where is growth happening? Where are good things happening in the economy? And as an entrepreneur and as a business person, look to those environments and say, okay, you know, what am I doing? If I'm in a business or if I'm looking for a business and I can do something that supports the agri sector, for example, here, it sounds like that's an opportunity that will potentially open up rather than close down in the current economic environments.
I really see three sort of major industries in the food business. One is agriculture itself, production. Mm-hmm. Second one is processing and your big processors and your small processors. And I don't think that the barriers to entry to start a mill are that great and to produce, say, bread. The third one is distribution. So there you need a relationship with your shop rights and your pick and pays and your other, your spaza shops and everybody else. So sort of three legs to it. And I quite honestly, I'm seeing a bit of agreement coming here that these are great opportunities for smaller smaller businesses. Mm. However, the land question, again, I go back to Brian Cantor. He's saying that why on earth are we sitting with these these apartheid era ex-homeland trust lands where the people who live there do not have title? He also says that RDP housing, which is produced and given by government, they're very valuable, these houses. They're very expensive. Why can't people have their title deeds? Now, we've seen in certain municipalities, and they're trumpeting it quite widely, Johannesburg and Cape Town, is they are saying how many title deeds they've actually issued to the owners of these houses. Once you have a house, once you have the land, you can borrow against it. You can get farm equipment. You can buy seed, and you can get down and you can farm. But that's plants, you know. And then we've also got animals, and the whole chicken thing has been pretty disastrous, as we've heard lately, accusations of dumping and so on. And so, you know, we had Brazilian chicken being produced. The prime chicken and turkey parts are breasts, white meat and so on, and they get exported to North America. They go to the United States and Canada. And what's left is the other parts of the chicken, which are already paid for. Once you've sold off your white meat and your luxury turkey bits, you're left with drumsticks, thighs, and wings. What do you do? You want to get rid of them? You can get rid of them cheap. So the South African chicken industry has been crying for a long time that they're really being hammered by dumping. Dumping actually is illegal if it's below cost, but we don't know that.
And that's always a challenge.
Can I be flippant about the chicken industry? There was a farm supplier going up to a chicken farm, and he drove up the driveway, and suddenly there was this massive cloud of dust, and something whizzed past the car. And then a little bit later, another one. And when he got to the farm, he said to the farmer, "Please, what have you got here? What are these? Is it supernatural beings or these things that are so fast?" He said, "No, no. We discovered, unlike the Americans, that people in South Africa like the drumsticks very much. So we have bred a three-legged chicken so that we get an extra drumstick out of every chicken." And he said, "That's fantastic. What do they taste like?" And the farmer said, "We don't know. We've never managed to catch one yet." So chicken pieces is another issue.
Exactly. Andrew, it's been really insightful. I think it is just so clear that the economic space we're in, I think we all get wrapped up in the headline stuff, but it's the stuff that's happening on the ground that really affects all of our businesses out there. And it's been great to hear some insights and some things to think about. So thank you for joining us. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me on the show. Thank you.
Next up is our practical business conversation. Stay with us. CliffCentral.com.